You're listening to the 2015 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust's Christian Leadership Conference, Understanding the New Millennium, Reexamining the Cultural Narratives. In the keynote session, Peter Greer talks about navigating the cultural landscapes, anchors, and sails.
Terry, I have to start with a confession. Part of the reason when we were having the initial call, part of the reason I wanted to hear more about you, part of the reason I wanted to make sure I was listening is because when I heard about this and I heard about all of you that were going to be here, knowing just a little bit about your background, I was sure that you made a mistake thinking that I was the person who was going to come to speak here to all of you. I thought that was a mistake. And after hearing Alyssa and Greg, I'm thoroughly convinced I'm the wrong person. This has been an unbelievable day, has it not? I mean, goodness. It has been so much fun to be with all of you and to connect with friends and to make some new ones. But tonight we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about anchors and sails. And how many of you are sailors? Great. I'm going to call on you then throughout regularly, because I've only been boating once, so this is probably the wrong analogy for me to use tonight. So you're going to be correcting me. And the other disclaimer as I start here is the fact that I started my day, because of the change in schedule, at 2 a.m. East Coast time on my way to the airport so I could be here for the start, which means I'm coming up on 24 hours, which means all of you are spinning right now. So just stay still. And we're going to need some interaction today because it's the end of the time. So I got a few prizes, and hopefully this is going to be a conversation. Who doesn't love free? Do people love free? All right, good. And if it just starts to go south, there's dessert. So it's all going to end well tonight anyway. So we're going to talk a little bit about anchors and sails. And so first of all, yes, gentlemen right there, tell us, what's the purpose of an anchor? Now, this is not a difficult question. this is not going well. Let's go to dessert. Let's just call it right there. Let's go. No, right? Anchor, right? As we think about moving forward, there are some things that we want to say we don't want to move away from, right? Anchors are there to keep us in a certain spot. And as we think about entering the new millennium, as we think about all these things that we're going to, it often is good to ask a question. What do we want to make sure that we don't move away from? And then sails. What's the purpose of sails? You guys, this is now, we're really moving. I'm giving away books here. You said sails right there. We're giving away prizes here. So that's right. So sails. So sails are to keep you moving. There are some things that are happening right now in our world. So there are some things that we don't want to move away from. And there are some things that we want to make sure we're recognizing. Culture, our world, things are changing. And we want to make sure we're paying attention to that and realizing this is a moment. This is a moment for us to catch some important winds. And so we're going to talk about anchors and sails. And how many points am I going to give you for anchors? Who said three? We're giving away all kinds of... Right there. I can't throw that far. Yeah, three. And then another trick question. How many are we going to do for sails?
Four.
Ah, I'm keeping the book. No, just kidding. Just kidding. Pass that to him. Yeah, three. So that's what we're going to do. And then hopefully it'll be time for question A conversation. And I'm going to get a workout tonight. And this is going to be fun. All right. So here we go. So what I am convinced of, I've been looking at this issue of mission drift and how organizations move away from their founding passions. How organizations move away from their founding passions and their Christ-centered identity over time. And here's my statement to all of you that I believe is conclusive based on history. The vast majority of your organizations will have nothing to do with Christianity within two generations. The vast majority of your organizations, if history is our guide, will have nothing to do with Christianity within two generations. That's a pretty sobering statement to open with, and yet I believe that it is true. It is the historical precedent that individuals like you, passionate about their faith, passionate about the gospel, built organizations that over time drifted from their core commitments and passions. Let me give you a couple examples. This individual, anyone know who he is? Who? St. Nicholas. Outstanding. And who's St. Nicholas?
He is the Bishop of Marin Lycia.
Did everyone hear that? Say it again.
The Bishop of Myra and Lycia.
Yes. Excellent. Good. And what else do we know about him? What else do we know about St. Nicholas? Santa Claus. We're giving you a gift too. Here we go. Santa Claus, exactly. And so Santa Claus is what we know. And he is known as patron saint of all sorts of things. The patron saint of Christmas and gift giving. I'm not going to give a book. I didn't ask a question, but you're right on that. So the patron saint, did you know that St. Nicholas is also known as the patron saint of pawn shops? Now, a good question. Did you know that? Yes. You're working really hard for a book. You're going to get one before the night is over here. The story of St. Nicholas, right, is that there were individuals in need, and so for the dowry, and he ended up going in the window and putting in the stockings. And so even with pawn shops, you look at their logo, it is three purses. And some people believe that that logo even ties to the story of St. Nicholas. Now, why would pawn shops have a patron saint? And why would pawn shops have a patron saint who is St. Nicholas? Anyone know anything about the history of pawn shops? Anyone been to one this week? When you go into a pawn shop, what is your first thought? What a group of loving people that are there to care for me. Is that the thing that you think when you go into a pawn shop? And yet, the story of pawn shops is a fascinating story because they were created by the Catholic Church as a way to care for people when they had short-term needs. They were created by the church and by caring friars that when you would go in, that you had a short-term need, they knew that there are times in life where people need to have access to capital. They knew that there was a short-term need, and so people could take their goods, something of value, and it was an ancient system of banking, where you could pledge something, you could give something, you could get access to capital, and then when you were back on your feet, you could go back and these individuals would give you back. So when you went into a pawn shop, you met people that loved you, people that cared about you. It was an outreach of the church. And yet today, my guess is across the street, you don't say, what dear people those pawn shop owners are. Something that was created to care for individuals in poverty has become a vehicle that is used to prey on people in poverty. It's not just with St. Nicholas. It's not just with pawn shops. How about this example, lest you think that this could never happen to you? This we find in Scripture. We open up the pages in Scripture, and one of these well-known verses that maybe you have crocheted on your wall. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. And then what is this powerful statement? And who says this? Joshua, and what does he say? Read it with me. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. What is he doing? He's making a declaration that is beyond his personal. He's saying, me and who? My household. And what is he saying? We will serve the Lord. How well did his household do? Not too good. Anyone know how long it took? Two generations. Two generations. And here's what it said here. This gentleman has worked so hard already. Give it to someone. All right. And then what happens within two generations? This is crazy. Just a few pages later, this is what it says. After that whole generation had been gathered up to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods of the peoples around them. You're exactly right. It's two generations. Two generations. It's people that didn't see with their eyes the great things that God had done, the amazing things in entering into the promised land, and they forgot. They became not just a little bit off course, but they completely forgot the God that had rescued them and brought them into the promised land. So we see it in history of pawn shops. We see it in the pages of Scripture. We also see it in stories of institutions. How about this as a mission statement of a well-known university? It says this: to be plainly instructed and consider well that the main end of your life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ. Harvard. It's not Harvard, it's Harvard. You get it. All right. I'm getting tired. I'm just going to put books up here afterwards. If you get it right, you can come up and grab it, because this is not going to work. To be plainly instructed, and that's right. And what is the motto? Veritas. And what does veritas mean? Truth. And what does it say literally on the diploma, even today? You see other words, Christo et Ecclesia. What does that mean? It means truth, what? For Christ and the church. When you walk around Cambridge, when you look at the buildings, you see it engraved in stone all around. The purpose of this institution, it was there to instruct individuals to know that the main end of your life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ. It is etched into the stone, and yet it is forgotten in the classroom. It's not saying that it's bad. It's not saying that it's not having a global impact. But it is saying that what it was created to do, it is no longer doing. You know, 100 years after the founding of Harvard University, there was a group of people that said, Harvard is drifting, and we have to create an institution that is staying on mission. And so they did what all smart people do. They eventually moved south. And where did they move? New Haven, Connecticut. And they founded Yale University. And they said, it's not enough just to have veritas. We want to make sure we're looking at truth, but always making sure that's after, in the light of Christ. We want to make sure that we do not forget it is lux et veritas. And yet, what happened to Harvard? What happened to Santa Claus? What happened to Yale? What happened in the pages of Scripture happened again, and it happened quickly. It happened really, really quickly. Let me tell you one final case study. Two organizations, and listen to the parallels. Listen to the parallels in their founding story. One organization, the first one, was founded by Dr. J. Calvert Clark. He was a Presbyterian minister. He went to a trip to China, saw incredible need. A missionary friend said, "Do you feel that Americans are doing all they can to help?" His conscience and his heart was pricked. He understood as he opened up the pages of Scripture that he was not supposed to walk by his brothers and sisters in need and do nothing. He was supposed to do something, and so he did. He's credited with founding the child sponsorship model in 1938, the organization he founded, and today it's one of the largest charities in America, serving over 2 million children. Listen to the parallel. Another story of another organization founded by Everett Swanson, also a Presbyterian minister. He also was on a trip to Asia. His trip was to Korea. Also, a missionary friend asked a question. You've seen the tremendous needs and unparalleled opportunities of this land. What do you intend to do about it? He also said, we're supposed to do something. So in 1952, he also founded an organization that uses child sponsorship to reach individuals. And today, they also are serving around 2 million children around the world. This is going to be a bonus question here, but can anyone tell me, what are these two organizations? Not World Vision. Yeah, good. So that's one. Compassion, the one with Swanson. And how about the other one, Dr. J. Calvert Clark? I see advertisements for this other group in airports a lot. Nope. I see a lot of care advertisements too. Oh, you guys are close. But it's an organization. I'm going to give a few more clues here. Sally Struthers. Do you remember the 80s? Infomercials. Do you remember that? Price of a cup of coffee. You can. What was the name of it? Who? Real close. Yeah. I'm going to give myself a book. It is Child Fund. Now, the interesting thing about Child Fund is in the 80s, when you heard Sally Struthers, she was talking about Christian Children's Fund. Do you remember that? Did someone say Christian Children's Fund? Somebody. Well, we're going to give that book to them, too, whoever said it. So Christian Children's Fund. Now, when the name was changed, it's interesting, because there were some people that were starting to raise questions, and we have some friends here from Christianity Today, and there was an article in Christianity Today that talked about this. They interviewed a board member, and the board member said this. They said, this organization has nothing to do with Christianity. But wait a minute, the organization is called Christian Children's Fund. What do you mean it has nothing to do with Christianity? And this is what President Ann Goddard said in 2009 publicly when they changed their name. This is what she said. She said, an organization changes slowly, and then all of a sudden you realize the changes have happened so much that you need to step back and see if you're putting out the name that really reflects who you are. Now, what is she saying? She's saying when we took a step back and when we actually looked who we are, we realized that there was nothing having to do with Christianity in our organization. They changed their name as a final decision about something that had been happening for decades, an organization that was founded with a clear and compelling call to bring the love of Jesus to children, and yet had slowly, over time, become something else. Now, the other organization that had so many similarities, there was an interesting article that was also written about this other organization, about Compassion. And there was a group of consultants that came in and they said, you've got the best name in the business, Compassion International. Who wouldn't want to be a part of Compassion International? But they said the Jesus stuff is polarizing. They said, downplay the Jesus stuff and then watch what will happen to your growth. And this was the response of President West Stafford. He said this. He said, we thought for 10 seconds and said, no, not now, not ever. That is the example of a mission true leader. And my hope in our few minutes today is that you, my friends and my colleagues, we need mission true leaders that understand the prevalence of drift and say and act in such a way that says, as for me, my house and this organization that I've been entrusted to steward, I want to make sure we do not forget that we offer the world more than just humanitarian assistance. We have the privilege of bringing the love of Jesus Christ to a world that desperately needs to see that. So the question, three anchors and then three sails. What are our anchors? And there are a lot. And as we started to think about this issue of mission drift, what we wanted to find is what can we find causality? Can we find those few decisions that then would cause drift to happen? And then what could we do to stop him? And what we found is that there was not one issue. But we tried to interview organizations that had scaled. Many of the organizations in this room, we interviewed your leaders. And we had an opportunity to listen over 200 hours of interviews from people that had grown organizations, had scaled organizations, had remained mission true, and then said, what's the difference between similar organizations that have drifted, and what can we learn from that? We did not find one issue. We found about 14 issues, and unfortunately, we couldn't figure out which one goes first and which one comes after that. But the reality is there are multiple decisions, and the word drift is so appropriate because it's simply, we just don't pay attention to it, and we don't even know that we're moving. So a couple things. I'm just going to give three here. The first one, that we found a unanimous in organizations that had remained mission true was this. There was no ambiguity that their faith mattered. There was no ambiguity at the very center of their organization about what they were about, and they understood the preciousness of their message. I love what Jesus says in Matthew 5. You're the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. And mission true leaders understood that there's something different. There's a saltiness. There is light. And that is directly because we understand that we are vessels, that the truth, God's timeless truth, gets to shine through. And that is a beautiful thing. Mission true leaders believed that their faith mattered, and they then took steps to make sure that they protected it. This is something that we hear in culture. This is something Jim Carrey said on Twitter. He said, I think everyone should get rich and famous to do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer. Now, I don't recommend getting rich and famous and doing everything you ever dreamed of to reach this conclusion, but this is one of these timeless echoes. It was echoed by the King Solomon with all of his wealth in the book of Ecclesiastes. It is echoed today in all of us. We recognize that there's something in us. There's something in us that is not easily satisfied. Something in us, eternity. We could have all of this and it still wouldn't be enough because we're wired for something more. I believe that culture is always going to be trying to find ultimate meaning, ultimate satisfaction, and is going to keep looking, keep longing for it until we find the beautiful truth of reconciled relationships in Jesus Christ. We have a faith that is precious. We have a message that is timeless. And organizations that remain mission true
do not have ambiguity about the preciousness of this message. Relatedly, then, they take steps to protect it. And we found that because they believe this, they have high clarity and high intentionality. So really what this means, they have clarity. Organizations that remain mission true did crazy things, like actually bake into their bylaws an impossibility of changing the primary purpose of their organization unless one organization has 3 consecutive years with 100% board unanimous vote to ever change the primary purpose of the organization. Organizations that stay on mission get creative about how we get clarity and intentionality about really protecting what matters. My experience is that most people take it for granted and have low clarity and low intentionality, and drift will happen. The funny thing about drift is it picks up speed too. The lower you are on clarity, the lower you are on intentionality, there is speed, there is velocity that picks up. It actually faster and faster until you get to a point that literally is a point of no return. Second thing, organizations that remain mission true differentiate the mission from the means. Now, we have some friends here from the YMCA, and so correct me if I tell this story wrong, but something happened as we were looking at kind of thinking about this. Any case study that we highlighted in the book was something that was publicly available documents. We were not doing investigative journalism. We were not trying to break any stories. We were only choosing organizations to highlight that publicly affirmed their new identity. And so after the book came out, I got a couple calls, and one that surprised me. There was a call from a leader of the YMCA, and I was a little bit nervous, I'll be honest, because I wasn't sure kind of what's the response going to be. And I pick up the phone, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "Peter, I want to thank you." And that was a good response, because I had not gotten that as the first thing out of some other people's mouths. But he said, "I want to thank you." And he said, "I want to tell you a story." He said, "A few years ago, we were doing a reconstruction project." He said, "We were doing a reconstruction project on our local Y." And he said, "As we tore down the wall," he said, "we found something. It was almost like a time capsule." He said, "We found 2 copies of the original story of why the YMCA was brought to the United States. Originally, it was founded in London as a way to reach displaced youth on the streets. It was brought to the United States by the evangelist Dwight Moody, and there was a passion and a clarity about spiritual restoration, about the full restoration." And he said, "Peter, as we read through our history and we compared the passion of the people that brought it here to what we were doing today," he said, "we wept." He said, "We wept because the reality is who we are today as a health club did not match the full holistic vision that individuals had." And he said, "There's a group of us that are coming together." And he said, "We're calling ourselves the C Project. And we're trying to bring Christ back into the YMCA." And he told me stories about how the YMCA is actually locally registered and how actually at the YMCA there's great variety and bringing spirituality, bringing Christ back in certain YMCAs is happening. And so the thing that I felt like was just so powerful in that is at some point, individuals within the YMCA thought that their mission was a health club, as opposed to full restoration, including spiritual restoration. They thought that the health club was the primary purpose. They got confused about mission versus the means. And that for all of us, when we're making decisions, the question is, why are we doing this? Is this to become truer to who we were created to be? Or is this a slow path of losing our passion for the primary vision that we have as an organization? Third thing we found mission true organizations had in common is they paid a lot of attention to hiring. They knew that every decision in hiring actually impacts the soil. And if the soil becomes a different soil, you're not going to have the same things that are going to grow. There's a fascinating story by Phil Vischer, the founder of VeggieTales. And did anyone else enjoy Greg singing today? Was that awesome? Does anyone want to hear Greg sing the VeggieTales theme song? I don't know if I believe him. If you like All right, we're going to skip it. Greg, your singing was really awesome. That was fantastic. But this story, what do VeggieTales do? They exist to bring Bible stories to life. If ever there was going to be an organization that would prevent drift from happening, wouldn't it be talking tomatoes and cucumbers that are telling Bible stories? Do you think you'd have to worry about mission drift happening with Larry and Bob as the spokespeople and the Bible as the basis? And yet there's this fascinating story that Phil Vischer tells, and he talks about a staff meeting. He talks about someone that was similar to a Jack Welch, is how he describes him, someone that had an incredible resume, someone that was brought into the organization. And he recognizes that there's some sort of misalignment that's happening. So at a staff meeting, Phil Vischer stands up to clarify the primary purpose of the organization. This is what they say. He says, "I'm a Christian, and I believe the Bible exclusively holds the truth about our standing before God and the path to restore our relationship with Him. I want to share that truth with our culture. That is, at the end of the day, what Big Idea is all about." Now, this is the primary purpose. And again, it's VeggieTales. He should not have to clarify that. And yet what happened next shocked him. The individual that had been in the position of leadership, all the hiring decisions, all the strategy decisions over the past 2 years, stood up and said this: "If that's what this is about, I need to opt out." There was misalignment with Bob and Larry. There was misalignment about the primary purpose of what the organization was created to be. If it happens to VeggieTales, it might just happen to you. So what are our sails? If those are the things, if those are some of the anchors that we can throw overboard, what are the sails? When I first started thinking about this, and really the initial topic was about kind of the connection to social justice. And the connection to social justice, and as I thought about the connection to social justice, I came to a bit of an unusual conclusion, is I don't think that's one of our sails. Sorry, because as I started to look at this issue of social justice, it's pervasive. It's all over the place. Social justice as a word, social justice as a term, is all over the place. It's ubiquitous. And it doesn't really differentiate followers of Jesus anymore. And I think that's actually a really great thing, that there's a movement that people care about others. There's a rise of social entrepreneurship. I think that's awesome. There's a rise of generosity. How about Mark Zuckerberg yesterday? Birth of his child, saying that he's going to give away 99% of his Facebook stock? Look at Bill Gates. Generosity. There's something here that's happening. So what makes us distinct? What makes us unique? What are the sails that we can have that says, this is something different about our faith? This is something that makes us different as followers of Jesus. And in the midst of this world, as we think about the new millennium, as we think about moving forward, what is happening that we can take advantage of? And I don't know, these are probably not going to be new to anyone, but they're the three big ones that I thought of about what are the sails? What can we use to propel in today's culture the timeless truth of Christ's saving grace? First thing, open-handedness. Now, this is something that, again, maybe it's found all over the place, but it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And part of the reason that I've been thinking about this is because not long ago, I ended up having we were working on a campaign, and we had this campaign, and we launched this campaign, and we use Exodus 4:2 as the tagline for this campaign to tell the story of Hope International. And the verse Exodus 4:2 is what's in your hands. And it kind of builds on this idea that oftentimes when God calls his people to do something, he often uses what God has already given them in their hands. And so whether it's Moses and his staff, or it's whether the widow and the oil, or whether it's 5 loaves and 2 fish, or whether it's a sling in David's hand, oftentimes God uses things that he already has given us. And so as we launched this kind of little devotional and message, I got a call from another ministry leader. And the message was this. He said, "We've trademarked Exodus 4:2, and you need to cease and desist using that because we've trademarked it." I'm not joking. And I thought God had the trademark, actually. But apparently not. They had a patent on Exodus 4:2. And I thought, that is just so counter to the message that we see in Scripture. It is so counter, and yet I believe it's pervasive. And I believe one of the things that we have an opportunity, to be light, to be salt in how we intentionally try to link arms with each other. And I love this. And honestly, these types of partnerships, they don't work when donors make them happen. They don't. They happen when real relationships form. And I love that we are here together. And I would just encourage you, those friends that you have, the people that are here, try to be ridiculously open-handed with them. Try to be open source with anything. And when you're sitting down at a table next to someone, try to learn what they're struggling with right now. And if you have something that could help them, be ridiculously open-handed with them, because I think that's an opportunity for us to be different. I think that's an opportunity when everyone is saying, me, 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 we can say we, oui, we, oui, we. Oui. That's French for all of us. There is an opportunity for us to say we want to be ridiculously open-handed, because really, what do we have that we have not been given? Right? That's what Paul writes. He writes it, what do we have that we haven't been given? And if everything that we have is a gift, how dare we hold on to it like it's ours? People don't partner with you because they want to build your organizations. People partner with you because they want to solve problems. And we can do that more effectively when we link hands. And I think when we link hands, I think when we become ridiculously open-handed with each other, rooted in lasting friendships, I think the world pays attention. And I think right now, with some of what Greg shared, some of the things that are happening in culture, I think there is an openness now that I've never seen to say we need each other. We need to stop thinking organizationally and start thinking about the kingdom. We start thinking about the kingdom that causes us to say, how can we help each other? How can we love each other? How can we serve each other? And I think the kingdom wins when we stop thinking organizationally and start being ridiculously open-handed with what we have. Second thing, second sale that I think there's an opportunity for us to do is to wash feet and dishes. Now, the challenge for all of us, right, in leadership, the challenge is that we get busy. Challenge is that we have more to do than time to do it. And the problem is that simple acts of service are not the highest and best and most efficient use of our resources. And yet, increasingly, I think this is an area for us to say we want to follow the example of Jesus that literally took off his outer garments, literally got down, literally got on his knees, and literally washed feet of his disciples and then asked us to go and do likewise. I think that there is an opportunity for us as we lead to look for those key moments that make no strategic sense, no strategic sense at all, but embody the gospel. I think there are opportunities, and I think that's part of the reason why there's this fascination right now with Pope Francis, because he's living it. You see that they're literally washing feet, and I think this should be the hallmark for all of us that follow the way of the Master, that we literally get down on our knees and wash feet. We at Hope International, our leadership team, every time a group of interns comes in, it's symbolic, but we literally get down in this initiation process and wash their feet. And it's not because their feet need to be washed, it's because we need to wash them. We need to be reminded that if we follow the way of Jesus, we're going to intentionally humble ourselves, we're going to intentionally get on our knees, and we're going to do things that don't make strategic sense, but embody the gospel and the Lord that we follow. Third thing that I think the opportunity is, I think there is an opportunity for us to pay attention to people that are really close to us. I think that if I were to ask you, and if I were to be honest, and not just this week as the throw-up bug is in my home, but how many of you, if you asked your spouse right now, how am I doing showing that apart from God, there's no higher love than you? Anyone want to tell me how they do in that sort of a question right now? My experience is that sometimes in the midst of all of this good work that we're doing for God, we can forget that ministry starts at home. We can forget to love people that are closest to us. And I think that this is another opportunity for us to love people that are closest to us. It's another sale that's going to say we're different because we take love seriously, and love starts at home. You know, I had a situation in 2009 where my wife came to me after the kids were in bed. She said to me, this woman that I love more than any other on this earth, and she said, Peter, I feel nothing for you. And that took me by surprise because I was doing God's work. I was loving and serving and going and solving problems. And for my wife to say, Your ministry has become your mistress. And I've been getting leftovers. And what was a busy month became a busy quarter, became a busy year. And you can only give someone leftovers before resentment starts to grow and the heart becomes callous and relationship starts to die. I wanted to change some things at that moment. And my guess is maybe some of you are in a similar situation. And maybe right now you should go home at the end of tonight and skip tomorrow. I believe there is an opportunity for us to love people that are closest to us. And my experience is that people involved in ministry that are passionate, talented, capable leaders oftentimes do a better job loving their end users, doing a better job loving their staff than they do loving their family. And I think that actually undermines long-term effectiveness. I think it undermines the gospel. And I think misses an opportunity for this world to say, we are serious about love. And because of that, we want to love people that are next to us. Our ministry starts at home. And oftentimes, that's the hardest one to pay attention to. So I believe there's opportunities for us to go forward. I believe there's a huge amount of excitement. But I believe that all of us need to remember, what does it look like for us to really seek to love God, to love our neighbors, to love our families? At Hope, if I could do anything to serve you, we're going to have a few minutes of Q&A, just a few minutes here. But if I could do anything to serve you, we are open source with everything. If anyone wants anything from operations manual to employee manuals, we love sharing it. So if there's anything that we could do to try and help, we would love to do it. So we're going to have, do I have any time, David?
He's good, David.
David, right. He's good.
I do. So we have a few minutes and I still have more books. So whoever has a question, we're giving, yes. Oh, you got to ask a question.
How old are you?
Ah, you know, great question. That's a great question because I'm going to do one more plug. Am I allowed to do this? So I just turned 40, and I found this fascinating thing that life satisfaction bottoms out in your 40s. And it's fascinating. So just wrote a book about midlife with someone who was on the other side about the pitfalls of midlife and kind of a mentor-mentee relationship. Oh, you wanted to show what it looks like. Thank you. So it's called 40-40 Vision. And that was the best question ever. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
In a world where you're finding a lot more of the funders are saying, we want you to diversify what you do, you know, we've been funding you for X number of years, there's a lot of pressure from the philanthropic community for nonprofits to shift in terms of their areas of focus and diversify either the individuals that they serve or the way that they provide the services. And so in response to the conversation around mission creep, I think there's some sensitivity to being anchored to some things, but also going back to the how or the, you know, how do you retain mission, but also at the same time diversify and satisfy a way to be funded so that you can continue to go forward with the core work?
Great question. And I had some people that after kind of talking about this, they said, no, don't talk about mission drift because my board is going to say every time we have a new idea, it's drift and it's going to cause us to stagnate. How dare you talk about, because then everything's going to be mission drift. So how do you innovate? The reality is the world is changing and we do have to innovate. But the question is our innovation in light of our primary purpose? And so it's not saying don't change, but it's saying change to be truer, to be more impactful today than you were yesterday. So, you know, Christian Children's Fund changed their name as, I believe, an example of drift. Talking with individuals from Campus Crusade for Christ that found that the very word crusade on campuses was closing doors. When they changed their name to Crew, I believe that was a mission true decision where they said our name change is not because mission drift is happening. It's so that we can better accomplish the purpose that we have as an organization to reach individuals with the love of Christ. Yeah, thank you. There was, yes.
Yeah, after your wife approached you in 2009, how did you change after that without abandoning the organization and all the responsibilities that you had?
Yeah, so the first thing that I did is I took Laurel away for a weekend thinking that I was going to repair years of damage in a 3-day weekend. Oh, laugh it up. I thought we'd be all better. And it didn't work. You're like, what an idiot. No, it didn't work. And the reason is because she needed to believe that the change was real, right? And so, you know, honestly, marriage is hard, and it's beautiful. And so for me, the change, I believe, finally came when I wrote my resignation letter. I put it in an envelope, and I gave it to her. And I said, if you ever feel that I'm not fulfilling my higher priority of loving you, then mail the resignation letter, and I will walk away from this organization and this job that I love. She mailed it twice, but I put the wrong address on it the first few times. But you know the funniest thing that it did, right? The funniest thing was that it actually changed my behavior, because I love what I get to do. I love what I get to do. And so it changed my behavior. It set up guardrails. I don't travel more than 6 nights a month right now. And I have a lot of early mornings. You can get to Portland by lunchtime, I found out today. And so you have a changed schedule, but I limit the number of travel nights, because travel is just a bear. There's just no easy way around it. And so there are some other practical things that we did in guardrails. I also asked my wife how I'm doing on a regular basis, because I don't want to be surprised again. I just didn't know how she was feeling. I'm not the most intuitive person in the world. And so I regularly ask her, hey, how am I doing? And how are we doing in this as well? Yes. Yes, right there.
I liked your idea of not allowing changes in the mission statement for a three-year period. One of the organizations I'm involved with, though, has, given some of the political climate, has wanted to change it for the better. And so the question I have is, you can certainly implement that policy to make sure that mission drift doesn't happen on the downside, but what happens if you actually want to do something that will further protect your organization?
Great, great, great question. And again, this is where it's the key word that we kept coming back to. If we had to say what were the refrains that we kept coming across, it was clarity and intentionality. And so decisions like that are done, there's got to be intentionality about it. We've got to think through the scenarios of where is this leading us and what does this actually mean for us. And so, again, it's not saying you want something to be so rigid that change is impossible. You just want to have safeguards in place so that change requires intentionality. And so for us, that's kind of the multi-year thing, that you just don't want to have one board meeting reacting to one situation in one moment of time without forcing yourself to have the habit of saying, this is big. This is really significant. What does it actually mean, and what is going to be the best way to accomplish our mission? Yeah, thanks. There was one there.
You gave a lot of examples of mission drift where people are far away from what they originally started. But do you have any good examples of organizations that have had significant mission drift and have come back to their true mission? Now, I know you use the YMCA, but it's still a work in progress and not yet there. But what organizations have really had that drift and have come back to their true selves of what they started with?
Yeah, great question. There are some examples, but they are hard to find. I do find that there are a lot of organizations that drift away, and very few are able to make these types of decisions to come back to a place. There is a wonderful story. If I was going to write one story, there's a group Humanitarian Services in Tyler, Texas, that has a great story of how they've just been really intentional about it. I think of Al Mueller, what he did with the seminary, Southeastern Seminary, of how he ended up making a decision. One of his opening speeches was, if anyone is here on staff on any other reason other than this as the primary purpose, he said, you're here on false pretense. And there was significant staffing challenges on that. But the more to that story, but he took a bold stance to help return to it. So there are some, but very, very few. We found that it was a one-way valve for most organizations. And by the time they realized this, it was almost impossible. Can I say one other thing on that? One of the areas that I talked about with the staffing issue was, you know, hire for heart and head. And oftentimes we have more intentionality about staff, and yet I believe that board recruitment and retention is an area that does not receive a whole lot of attention. And typically the board process to recruit someone is, you know, someone who maybe has supported it or someone who's influential. You don't know if they're interested in joining the board, so what do? You go ask them. You say, hey, Peter, would you consider joining my board? And to your shock, I say, yes, I'd love to. And then you get to a point where then you, in the due diligence process, you say, now tell me about your faith journey. And I say, I go to church on Christmas, whether I need to or not. And that's it, you know? And you find there's misalignment in terms of the core purpose. Now, what do? You can't retract what has been a tacit invitation, or that would cause me to be offended and, you know, influential or supportive individual. And so most boards, I've seen this, I've been on boards, most boards say, well, it's just one. Be like evangelism dating, right? It's just one, and we'll bring him in and we'll win him over to the cause, you know? We'll bring him. And oftentimes, one board member can change the conversation in a really significant way. And so I think that this is actually a really important area to say, what's your board process? How do you make sure that you have a margin of error of zero in how you recruit board members? So how are you making sure that you're recruiting before they ever know that you're recruiting for them? And how do you have a much further outward looking, so you're looking for people before you actually need them, cultivating those relationships so that they're a known person before they're invited in to be the guardian of the mission? Most people have no idea what they're guarding when they come as a board member. I want to be sensitive of time because I know we've got dessert waiting.
Peter, let's do one more.
All right, last question.
Here, I got a mic.
Oh, I didn't give books.
This is just a comment, and then it's the other side of an earlier question. I guess I just want to affirm for everyone that grantors take mission statements very seriously and do look at them in terms of, does it fit? And sometimes it's really sad when you read a mission statement and then you go, what in the world do those words mean?
Yeah.
And then I think sometimes it is really hard when the mission drift we have to deal with is, as was said earlier, I think people are feeling they have to keep innovating. Mm. But sometimes well-meaning organizations, faith-based organizations, it's like what they do gets broader and broader and broader. And then again, we're put in the position to say, this isn't a bad idea. But again, how does it fit with who they are fundamentally? And how many things can they really do well?
Yeah.
And that's the other side of the challenge.
Yeah, thank you. And I didn't talk about this, but...
Peter, let me just say this.
Yeah.
That was Gail. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to say this was Gail Weyerhaeuser. She and her husband, Bill, chaired the board of the Stewardship Foundation. So that's directly from a grantor. So thank you for those words.
Yeah. The reality right now, I believe, is that there is incredible influence with the finances that God has entrusted to all of us. And very few people use it to the extent that it is possible. I have had so many people that have said, you're not eligible for funding because of your faith. There are so many people that put one prominent foundation lists no faith component at all as number one. Number two is no terrorist activities. They literally have like faith as a higher like concern than terrorism right now. And yet the other side is beautiful. This is an opportunity to say money does have an influence, and it is an opportunity to help organizations remember your primary purpose of who we are. So thank you. And how awesome that we get to be here with the Murdoch and the Stewardship Foundation, who are helping all of us stay more true to who we are. And so I want to just close us in prayer, if that's all right. And then, God, thank you for this group, and thank you for your grace. Thank you for your grace when we don't get it right. Thank you for your grace when we stumble. Thank you for your grace each and every day. And I pray that you would empower each of us to do the work that you've called us to do, of loving you, of loving our neighbors, and doing all of this with great joy, knowing the privilege it is to be your hands and feet. God, thank you for this group. I pray you would keep them mission true and that you would truly bless and prosper the great ministries that are here. And we pray all of this for your name and for your glory. Amen.